to make way for the world's first hydrogen bomb manufacturing complex, the Atomic Energy Commission swallowed up 300 square miles of land in three counties, an area four times the size of Washington, D.C. Whole towns were wiped off the map forever.
These reactors have malfunctioned and had the fuel rods have melted down, and this was kept covered up by the DuPont Corporation and by the Department of Energy and the Atomic Energy Commission before it.
A number of accidents among the tanks due to faulty design and human error have allowed high-level radiation to escape to the surrounding soil.
We also had another guy who worked there as a mechanic, worked there for 22 years, became sick because of exposure to radiation. The minute he became sick, they fired him. No benefits or anything.
Oh my God.
No outside studies of contamination at Savannah River have been undertaken. Secrecy protects the Energy Department and its contractors from having to explain how they do business.
Well, yeah, it's won awards all over the world. It's been to film festivals all over the world, got an Academy Award nomination in this country, won first place at a number of film festivals. It's been on television a lot outside the U.S.
Oh.
We've tried to get it, we offered it free to public television in this country, and they've refused to run it. I think they're afraid of offending some of the nuclear industry, who are some of the big corporate sponsors of PBS.
Right. Nuclear bombs, nuclear power, nuclear waste. These are the subjects of a lot of people's opinions and a documentary which we'll present to you right now on Alternative Views. We're real fortunate on Alternative Views to have Mark Morey with us, who, along with Susan Robinson, made an incredible documentary called Building Bombs. It's about the Savannah River plant, where they make, you know, they got all kinds of nice things there, like plutonium, and they build all these, which they provide for the nuclear weapons, which have been proliferated around the world. But Mark has kind of blown the whistle on the organization, the outfit, and it's one of these documentaries which I'm sure you'll want to see. We'll be able to see portions of it on this Alternative Views, but we're going to find out the story behind Building Bombs and something about Mark Morey.
Mark, we understand that Building Bombs was your first film, that it took 5 years to make, and it got nominated for an Academy Award. What led you to make the film in the first place?
Well, I was living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time, and a friend of mine was telling me about this Savannah River plant, which is over on the border between Georgia and South Carolina. And I realized the place was a big secret. It was a big mystery. Here was really the key nuclear weapons factory in the United States. And I considered myself politically knowledgeable, started asking my friends, and nobody knew what it was about. So I thought it would be a good subject for a film.
It hadn't gotten any attention in the media. There wasn't really any discussion. Had there ever been any accidents or spills?
There had been accidents and spills, but they had all been kept secret. And this is part of what I discovered in the course of making my film.
A number of accidents among the tanks due to faulty design and human error have allowed high-level radiation to escape to the surrounding soil.
Over the years, nine of the tanks, the older design tanks, have developed cracks. Leaks developed in tank 16 just a few months after it was put into service. It's a million-gallon tank of the old design, not the modern design. The waste overflowed, the 5-foot-high annulus pan into the soil surrounding the tank. It's in the water table.
At the time that we started to make the film, there was nothing in the press about it. People didn't even realize that it was a bomb factory. People thought it was a nuclear power plant.
Did you have any trouble with the government or with the company trying to do the documentary? I noticed you have shots there, beautiful shots inside the place, and talked to all kinds of people. You must have gotten a lot of cooperation.
Well, we didn't initially get any cooperation. Initially, they did not want to let a film crew inside the place. They said it was top security. It's higher security there than a military base. And they said they had a policy of not letting film crews in, which I believed. But they did offer me some film footage and of what was going on inside there. So they promised me this, and they promised me this, and I kept asking them for it, and they kept stalling and kept saying, well, you know, you can have this footage. And finally, they sort of sheepishly embarrassed said, well, you know, we don't really have very good film footage. So they kind of relented and let me bring a film crew inside, which I then did on 4 subsequent occasions also.
How safe has that plant been in the past? I noticed the government has shut it down. Does that mean there have been problems there?
Well, there's lots of problems there. They have 5 reactors there for making plutonium and tritium, which is the explosive part of a nuclear weapon. And these reactors, like I said a minute ago, these reactors have malfunctioned and had the fuel rods have melted down. And this was kept covered up by the DuPont Corporation and by the Department of Energy and the Atomic Energy Commission before it. And it was only a couple of years ago that this came out.
No outside studies of contamination at Savannah River have been undertaken. Secrecy protects the Energy Department and its contractors from having to explain how they do business. For 35 years, DuPont dumped toxic and radioactive liquid wastes directly into open pits at the rate of 200,000 gallons a day. Turtles swimming in these pits became contaminated with strontium-90, one of the most dangerous elements giving off strong radiation. They were discovered at various locations outside the plant, including a commercial hog farm.
We have captured many of them and brought them back on the plant site. We have fully apprised the owners of the land where the animals have been that this has been the case. Obviously, the levels were high enough to detect and to be of concern to us because we are taking action to try to eliminate this problem.
They have buried radioactive waste in cardboard boxes there for 30 years.
Even though the radioactivity in each one of those cardboard boxes was generally speaking very low, collectively it was a large amount of contamination. The use of cardboard boxes causes collapse of the trenches and a collapse of the soil columns on top the trenches, and is ultimately going to cause the failure of the burial ground. It has caused the failure of every burial ground in the United States.
Failure means radioactivity escapes beyond the boundaries of the burial ground.
This only came out, that one of the people I feature in the film, it only came out when he exposed it publicly. When he blew the whistle, all of a sudden they decided this wasn't such a good idea to bury radioactive waste in cardboard boxes.
Good Lord, I mean, anybody who knows anything would say that that was foolish.
Well, that's what you would think, but see, the problem with the Savannah River plant and other plants like it within the Department of Energy complex is nobody was checking up on what they were doing. They were free to do whatever they wanted. It was under the guise of national security, and so they did anything and everything.
So does this mean that nuclear weapons production is not under the same constraints or regulations as the nuclear energy industry? And we know what problems the nuclear energy industry has had with Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and any number of lesser problems. In view of that, wouldn't you think that nuclear weapons would be factories would be just as stringently regulated?
Well, you've hit a very important point. The nuclear weapons industry has been under no regulation of any kind at all. They were exempt from federal pollution laws, and it was only when some of the states began to come in and be concerned about these issues that the federal government paid any attention to it. So it has been a serious problem because of the national security and an arrogance by the bomb makers. They have literally dumped radioactive waste in the backyard of all these places without regard for what it would do to the environment.
Is this an effect of the Cold War, that the veil of secrecy over nuclear weapons production was justified according to grounds of national security or something, because we're in a life and death struggle with communism? Is that the sort of rationale they give?
That's precisely the rationale, that because the nuclear weapons production itself needed to be kept secret, that all aspects of this were kept secret. There was no checking up by anybody. In fact, it was the government was supposed to be using corporate entities like DuPont, Westinghouse, General Electric to operate these plants and telling them what to do. But what comes out in my film that you can see is the corporations were actually telling the government what to do. If a corporation like DuPont did not approve a report analyzing the problems, then the report would be killed. This is what we show in Building Bombs, a whistleblower that has a very heart-wrenching story that goes through a personal crisis and change of heart when he realizes that he's being asked to cover up and endorse a huge radioactive waste problem.
And I wanted to see all of the stones uncovered and looked under. And after I'd been involved in it a few months, then I found out only a very superficial report would be acceptable. In fact, the more superficial, the better.
Department of Energy managers signed the report and sent it to DuPont. Lawless expected some action to be taken as a result of his findings.
The report had a profound effect or impact on DuPont, and DuPont called the Department of Energy and had the report recalled.
Lawless was given the report back and asked to rewrite it. He did, adding new evidence each month. It was rejected again, and again, and again. After 2 years, management asked him to stop working on it. The report was killed.
So what the Cold War has meant, while we were focused on the Soviet Union,
right,
and while we thought that the problem was building weapons to defend ourselves from the Soviet Union, we were being poisoned by our own government, is essentially what happened.
And why were the corporations concerned to kill some of these reports? Because they were making big profits from it, because they didn't want to be criticized, or what were their...
Well, it wasn't so much that they were making big profits. DuPont, in the case of the Savannah River plant, was technically not making profit, but they wanted to avoid liability. They did not want to be stuck after they've dumped millions of gallons of radioactive.
They didn't want to clean it up.
They didn't want to clean it up. They didn't want the liability of the sicknesses it would cause and that sort of thing.
Okay.
I think there are some other fascinating aspects about your documentary. One is that this whole building of the plant itself, first of all, it came in and destroyed how many acres or how many square miles?
300 square miles of South Carolina. Six towns were just wiped off the map and taken over by the government in order to build the Savannah River plant.
To make way for the world's first hydrogen bomb manufacturing complex, the Atomic Energy Commission swallowed up 300 square miles of land in three counties, an area four times the size of Washington, D.C. Whole towns were wiped off the map forever. 6,000 people from 1,500 different families had to move.
And in fact, a couple of people who resisted this were put in mental institutions, the kind of thing we're told happens only in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And then there was this whole new economic and social structure that was come in and dumped down right in the middle of it.
This was Aiken, South Carolina we're talking about. It became the company town of the bomb plant.
14,000 people have jobs at the Savannah River plant today that wouldn't have them if it were not for the Savannah River plant. And they're not just common, ordinary laboring jobs. They're jobs, high technology jobs. The influx of this many PhDs and Masters of Science and other people that have come into the area has had a tremendous influence on this city and this area and the state of South Carolina.
And it's a typical company town kind of situation. It's a rural southern area. They are economically dependent on this place. These are the highest paying jobs in the state of South Carolina. A floor sweeper there starts at $15 an hour. So their only alternative is to work in a textile mill for $5 an hour or work in a cotton field. So you can, and the press there, the newspapers, controlled by the plant, the former editor of the plant newspapers, editor of the town newspaper. So they only got one side of the story. But when I showed Building Bombs there, my film, oh yeah, they, yeah, it got a very positive response from
really?
People. I mean, they came in to the film hostile. They had been told that this film was threatening their jobs. And in fact, the employer at the plant, which later became Westinghouse, encouraged people to go out and see the film because I think they were saying to them, you have to oppose this and protect your job. But people saw their own kind in the film, talking their own language, and it rang true with them. So we got a very positive response from even the people that work at the plant about the film.
How did you get people that were former employees or even current employees to talk? Had there been a lot of disease, a lot of radiation, sicknesses, or did people just have a pang of conscience that led them to speak out?
Well, in a couple of cases, it was people that had gone through a change. One was a physicist that had worked at the place for 30 years and really had retired. And once he retired, then he felt the need. He hadn't been happy with what he had been doing there, and he felt the need to speak out.
He realized that during his years at the plant, the country's stockpile had grown to greater than 30,000 of the bombs dropped on Nagasaki.
It seemed rather obscene. I just could not conceive of our need for that many weapons. It filled me with a sense of revulsion. I went away and felt that I had to do some thinking about what I'd seen and what I was involved in.
We had an engineer who was in charge of all the low-level radioactive waste management at the plant, who, like I mentioned a minute ago, once he began to be directly involved in the cover-up, he couldn't live with himself, quit his job, became a whistleblower, took a job for one-third of his former salary because he thought the threat of radiation in the environment was so great to people that he had to sound that alarm. We also had another guy who worked there as a mechanic, worked there for 22 years, became sick because of exposure to radiation.
He was diagnosed as having polycythemia vera. This rare blood disease is seen in people who live at high altitudes and those exposed to radiation.
The people there, workers, I mean, we didn't think there was anything wrong with it. You couldn't see it and nothing else, so we just thought you could eat the darn stuff and it wouldn't hurt you at all, so. We didn't pay it too much attention. We had somebody supposed to be checking us out and checking with it. And we depended on them to do their job, the same as we were doing ours as a mechanic.
4 years after leaving the Savannah River plant, George Couch tested positive for tritium in his blood.
The minute he became sick, they fired him. No benefits or anything.
Oh, my God. Even after 22 years.
Right.
How safe actually is the plant itself? Now, the government shut it down a while back.
Well, the government shut it down because they cannot safely operate the reactors. They even admitted that. And they recently tried to restart the K reactor there, one of the five big reactors, after spending several $1 billion trying to refurbish this 40-year-old reactor and get it to operate. Even then, it wouldn't operate properly. They ended up spilling radioactive water into the Savannah River. For 100 miles downstream, all the communities had to shut off their water intakes so that people wouldn't have radioactive water running out of their faucets.
This was exposed in the New York Times,
right.
Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a couple years ago? There were some front page articles
right.
on this that sort of uncovered the veil of
right.
Secrecy. Did you have anything to do with that? Were you connected to those reporters? Or anyway, I take it you were making your film by then.
Right. These articles came out in the New York Times in late 1988. We had actually started making our film in 1984.
Right.
And for most of that period, we're unaware of anybody else trying to do this story, which I thought was incredible, that all the mainstream media was around. Nobody's digging into this situation. And just about the time we were finishing our film, articles began to come out in the New York Times exposing some of these things. So actually, it really helped exposing everything, that all of our material began to hit at the same time.
How safe is the Savannah River project and the reactors compared to Chernobyl?
Well, I think they're a little safer as long as they keep them shut down. But the one physicist we have in the film who helped design the reactors at Savannah River Plant, he calls it a Chernobyl accident waiting to happen.
In the wake of the Chernobyl disaster, concern across the United States arose over the Energy Department's aging weapons facilities. Once widely touted as an economic boon, the Savannah River plant's presence was openly debated. It was reported that the Energy Department was routinely releasing large amounts of airborne radioactive gases into the atmosphere and covering up serious reactor accidents, including incidents of fuel rods melting during operations.
These things have no containment domes. These reactors could not operate for a single day if they had to come under the regulations that commercial power reactors are subject to. These reactors have no containment domes. If there is an explosion, it will spew radiation all over the countryside, which did not happen in Three Mile Island because it has a containment dome. So in a sense, there's some aspects of these reactors that are even less safe than Chernobyl.
Hasn't there been any attempt by Congress, since the New York Times articles and your film, to regulate the production of nuclear weapons? I mean, this seems just an unbelievable scandal. And I would think there'd be public pressure just simply to pass some laws to regulate production of nuclear anything, be it energy or weapons.
Well, there has been some attempts in Congress to do some things. I think one thing that happened was some congressmen put their faith in Admiral Watkins, the new Secretary of Energy, and I think they've become disappointed in him because they've seen, even though he stated that he was trying to change the culture at the Department of Energy, basically things have not really changed. And so some brave congressmen and senators have tried to do something, but really it's such a humongous problem, they haven't even been able to get a hold of it.
I mean, at the end of the Cold War, we don't need any more nuclear weapons. I've read that there's a scandal that we have twice as many nuclear weapons now as could conceivably ever be used. And so there's obviously no need to produce any more nuclear weapons for the next 100 generations. So it seems like it's a logical process just to wind down nuclear weapons production.
Well, one of the things I found is there's nothing logical about the nuclear weapons industry. From the way they dealt with waste, the massive numbers of nuclear weapons they produced, now they want to restart these old, decrepit, worn-out 40-year-old reactors to keep producing nuclear weapons for another 10 or 20 years, and they are trying to build new reactors so they can keep producing plutonium and tritium and nuclear weapons well past the middle of the 21st century. I mean, there's no conception that things have really changed.
That's a scandal.
How is your film been received? I noticed the New York Times had very glowing reports on it and reviews. Where else is it shown? Has it won awards anywhere?
Well, yeah, it's won awards all over the world. It's been to film festivals all over the world, got an Academy Award nomination in this country, won first place at a number of film festivals. It's been on television a lot outside the U.S.
Oh.
We offered it free to public television in this country, and they've refused to run it. I think they're afraid of offending some of the nuclear industry, who are some of the big corporate sponsors of PBS.
Right.
But so we have actually successfully now gotten it around in some theaters. So I would suggest people can watch and see if it shows up in a local theater in their area. And hopefully, because of that, we'll be able to get it into some video stores also.
What were the reasons that the PBS gave you?
The reason that PBS told me that they refused to run Building Bombs was it fails to give adequate voice to the proponents of nuclear arms.
Oh, for heaven's sake, well, you have people all throughout who are pro-Savannah River Project, pro-nuke.
Well, not only that, the pro-nuclear people have had dominated the media for the last 40 years.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not like, you know, there's been the point of view that is expressed in my film has come out very much, because it hasn't. So that's why it's a pretty thinly veiled over the real reason, which is that these DuPont, Westinghouse, GE, these big corporations whose logos you see on PBS are really what they're afraid of.
Well, this also is totally specious because it fails to understand the very nature of documentary film, which is not like a network news production where you're supposed to show both sides of the story. In fact, there's been a PBS series called Point of View that showed documentaries that took a very specific point of view. And over the past few years, whenever there's been documentaries on PBS that are too much to the left, they always have a discussion after with people representing the other point of view, although I've never seen them do this when there's a conservative documentary or show that they give the other point of view. So that just doesn't hold any water.
Right.
In fact, how do you perceive documentary film? What's your notion of the documentary, and how do you conceive your own work as a documentary filmmaker?
Well, you know, making documentaries is very difficult. It takes a passion and a commitment. And so I think any documentaries that receive notoriety are probably worth seeing just because of the number of obstacles that have to be overcome in making them one. I mean, there's no money in making them. So it just represents a passion and a commitment, and it allows people to look in on a world that maybe they wouldn't otherwise see. So while officially documentaries are ignored a lot, I think, it behooves people to seek them out.
And what do you see the role of your film doing as exposing and revealing or articulating your own point of view? What was your own sort of sense of what you were doing?
Well, my sense of what I was doing was, in a sense, was telling a good story, an entertaining story, but at the end of it, you know, you really had to sit up and think and say, you know, there's something I can do about this, there's something I should do about this, there's something going on here that I need to find out more about. So that was my objective.
What about nationwide and even worldwide? There are Savannah River-type projects all around. Are they having the same problems that folks in Aiken, South Carolina?
Well, yes. All the Department of Energy facilities are shut down at this point. Rocky Flats in Colorado, Hanford up in Washington, Fernald in Ohio, they've all got the same problems. All these plants are 40 or 50 years old. They're worn out. And the Department of Energy doesn't really want to face up to the fact that they should just be shut down permanently. And there's these same problems in the Soviet Union. And in fact, as bad as the problems are here, they're worse in the Soviet Union with their bomb factories over there.
So it's a perfect time worldwide simply to shut down nuclear weapon production. It seems that there's more than enough nuclear weapons to blow up the world many times. The Cold War is supposedly over, so wouldn't this be the time, really, to promote the shutting down of nuclear weapons production on a worldwide scale?
Well, I think that's certainly true, and films like Building Bombs and Deadly Deception are very timely for that reason, I think. And we need to face up to the fact that we don't need any more nuclear weapons, and we need to find a problem with the nuclear waste. We've had nuclear waste now for 50 years, yet we have not found any solution to it, and there's a lot of it out there.
Let's take a look back at some of the previous Alternative Views programs in which people expressed their opinions about nuclear power. First, we'll have Dr. Helen Caldicott, a pediatrician who's the author of Nuclear Madness, followed by Randy King, who survived the Three Mile Island disaster.
An article last week in Business Week, a very conservative business magazine, saying that nuclear power is economically almost dead but very sick. And they don't print those, and Wall Street Journal's been saying this too. So the fact is that nuclear power is heavily subsidized by the government, and what people may not know is that to enrich uranium, and that's what you put in a nuclear reactor, it's like putting wood in a fire, you put uranium in a reactor, it's extremely energy consuming, and uranium enrichment alone in this country uses 3% of all the electricity generated. So you have to take that off, the amount of electricity generated, to get a good figure, an accurate figure. Each nuclear reactor only lasts about 15 to 30 years, and then they become so radioactive that you can't send people in them to operate them because they'll be so irradiated they could get cancer or have deformed children. So then they have to either take them apart by remote control and bury the parts somewhere for a long time, isolated from the environment, or cover them up with half a mile of concrete and earth for half a million years, and nobody must dig into them because they're terribly dangerous. So that's called decommissioning. That's not taken into the cost of electricity. And massive amounts of very poisonous radioactive waste are produced in reactors. The government hasn't the faintest idea what to do with it. There's just been a national survey done by the Department of Energy asking the public what they should do with the nuclear waste. And they don't know. And it has to be stored from the environment for 1 million years. And a recent survey by the EPA using MIT geologists says that whatever they put this waste in, it's so hot and radioactive, be it glass, ceramics, metal, or whatever, will start to disintegrate within 10 years. And it has to be isolated for 1 million years. Now, the cost of this has never been considered in the cost of electricity from nuclear power.
Well, on the morning of March 28, 1979, through a combination of technical errors and human errors, the worst commercial nuclear accident in the history of the nuclear power industry developed. That accident brought the core of Unit 2 reactor to within a half an hour of melting down.
And what would have happened had it melted down?
If it would have melted down, it would have probably have wiped out the entire eastern seaboard from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia to New York City.
My God, how is that possible? I mean, what would have happened?
Well, if the core would have melted down, it would have melted through the bottom of the containment building, which was a 4-foot thick concrete structure, and hit the water table beneath the island and exploded in radioactive steam. The radioactive steam would have then dispersed throughout the entire eastern seaboard. At the time of the accident, there were 7 radiation monitoring devices placed around the plant. Only 2 of those were operational. The monitoring devices that were on the stacks of the containment building at the time of the accident had a top reading of 1,000 millirems. They were off scale for better than three days after the accident began. So, in effect, we really don't know exactly how much radiation we have received. I do know that in the 9 months after the accident, the infant mortality rate, miscarriages, and hypothyroid diseases amongst young children went up tenfold.
Of human beings in the
area. Of human beings, yes.
I've seen some pictures in the Village Voice of animals, a lot of miscarriages or strange creatures that were born from animals,
yes.
Deformities of certain sorts. Have you seen any of these, and
yes,
was this a widespread phenomenon?
In the areas that the plume passed over, yes, and I have seen some of those animals, such as Siamese cows being born, and cows with 3 legs, a cow with an eye in the middle of its forehead, a cat with no bones in the back of its body, things of that nature. It was very sad. One specific thing where the plume passed over, it was about an acre wide area, and it hit some trees, and some of the trees had leaves on one side and no leaves on the other side.
So there's no question that a lot of radioactivity was released from Three Mile Island, and it's had lethal effects.
Yes.
Well, there have been radioactivity placed into the water of the Susquehanna River, right?
During the time of the accident, 2,000 gallons were released into the river. They found radioactive rat droppings in the containment building last year. They quickly said that there was no danger to the public safety and that none of the rats had left the island. We ask, how did they know none of the rats have left the island? Do they take roll call every morning? That pretty much explains how GPU deals with the general public. At the time of the accident, General Public Utilities had $300 million in insurance money, and they predicted that cleanup process would take $40 million and 6 months. 6 months later, it was $400 million and 5 years. Several months ago, it was $1.5 billion and 18 to 20 years. They have no money to clean up Three Mile Island now. The federal government says it will not give them any money to clean it up. So now the ratepayers are being saddled with it. Their rates have gone up some 70%. We feel that the utility and the nuclear industry and nuclear utilities around the country and the federal government, either through funding or through legislation requiring the nuclear industry to pay for the cleanup, is what should happen. Harrisburg and Hiroshima are sister cities.
After the disaster at Three Mile Island, Dr. Helen Caldicott returned with a program called Medical Implications of Nuclear Power.
That's what the nuclear industry have called for years the melt through to China syndrome. And that's why the movie was called The China Syndrome. And when that happens, there'll be a huge steam explosion which will rupture the containment vessels and release the radiation inside. And there's as much radiation in these reactors as that released by 1,000 Hiroshima-type bombs. That's why the NRC officials were sweating on national television. They should have ordered evacuation, because when you read the government documents, I've just written a paper on this, if there was a meltdown, it would totally and permanently devastate an area the size of Pennsylvania. But you have to keep it quiet. Remember, if you read the tapes, Henry, who's the head of the NRC, said, "Is there a law for freedom of the press? If there is, I'm against it." And all through the tapes, they were talking about how to keep this quiet. We won't evacuate yet because it would be bad publicity for the nuclear industry. What has to happen for the people of the world to wake up? These are huge death machines. It would be a catastrophe the likes of which the world has never seen before. Worse than Hiroshima. Worse.
I'd really like to hear a bit more about the radiation leakage at the Savannah River nuclear plant. They make all of our weapons-grade plutonium there, you might realize. And as you may have heard, people from seven South Carolina towns ringing the plant have contracted a rare blood disease associated with exposure to radiation. A spokesman for the Energy Department said that they had no knowledge of these reported cases. But they had nothing to do with the plant, of course. Some 700,000 people live within 60 miles of the Savannah site, which is owned by, guess who, the Energy Department, and run by our big buddy DuPont. Now, this could be the start of something big. Y'all stay tuned. The Savannah plant surely has state-of-the-art radiation shielding to protect surrounding citizens. Are we now to understand that all of our safety precautions and all of our nukes aren't quite as adequate as we thought? Should we maybe rethink or recalculate this whole thing? I'm just curious. I'm also curious about these Love Canal home sites that the Environmental Protection Agency says are once again inhabitable. Did all that poison really just up and go away? You see, lately I've gotten this funny way of looking at government agencies. I don't trust them. Isn't that terrible? But I do think we could resolve this whole matter of agency credibility with one easy step. The government, that's we the people, owns the land in Love Canal, right? Well, let's throw up a few prefabs there and outfit them with window units, heaters, and water coolers and the like. Then we can move Ann Gorsuch and the EPA to their new Love Canal headquarters. They can live in the abandoned houses there, of course. And if they're all still healthy after a couple of years, we'll know it's safe to build condos there and put them on the market. In Savannah, until we get Quonset huts set up, the Energy Department can stay at the nearest Holiday Inn. There's an old saying in the military, a good leader won't ask a man to do anything that he wouldn't do himself. Now, I can get behind that. As a matter of fact, for my own spiritual well-being, this is definitely one of those times that I'd say, you first, fearless leader.
Next on Alternative Views, we're going to take a look back at a program we did with author Harvey Wasserman, who wrote Killing Our Own, about the dangers of nuclear power. Here are some of his comments.
We still don't know how much radiation escaped. All the major methods of measuring radioactive emissions during the Three Mile Island accident completely broke down. Uranium miners have a 5 times normal lung cancer rate because of the ingestion of radon gas. There are literally billions of tons of these highly radioactive tailings scattered all through the West. And it significantly alters the background levels of radiation in the world. In fact, he recently published some papers calculating the health impacts of the Chernobyl accident. Oh. And his basic assessment is that given the amount of radiation that escaped, there will be 900,000 additional human cancer cases around the world over the next 30 years, half of them fatal. A long time ago, the AEC, Atomic Energy Commission, conceded that at a major meltdown, you would permanently depopulate an area the size of Pennsylvania.
The United States alone is armed with 25,000 nuclear warheads. 17 facilities across the country are involved in the research, design, testing, and production of nuclear bombs. These facilities have accumulated approximately 300 million cubic feet of radioactive waste. Cleanup of these sites, where possible, could cost 100 million. At Hanford, Rocky Flats, Savannah River, and other weapons-making sites, citizens are suffering from DOE negligence and secrecy. In recent months, the Department of Energy has at least been trying to clean house and is now admitting its own gross mismanagement. States are closing their borders to hot trash as they come to grips with the nuclear waste dilemma. In the southeastern plains of New Mexico, WIP, or the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, nears completion after 10 years construction. Millions of years ago, the ocean left vast salt deposits here. 100 acres of connected caves have been carved into these ancient salt beds, 1/2 mile underground. Here, military nuclear waste is destined to be sealed away for a minimum of 10,000 years. Nuclear waste will be traveling through 28 states, perhaps through your neighborhood, on its way to WIP. In communities along the nuclear corridor, concern is growing.
The Department of Energy predicts that there'll be 1,450 shipments a year through New Mexico. I-25 will receive 1,000 shipments a year, which will be about 3 shipments a day past Las Vegas. Other waste will be coming from South Carolina and from Tennessee, Ohio, and Illinois on I-40.
One of my major concerns is that there'll be an accident. The city of Roswell has passed an ordinance saying that the trucks will not be able to come through Roswell except between midnight and 6 a.m. DOE is already challenging that ordinance, saying that that ordinance won't be enforced.
What if one of those trucks come by and hits the bridge and one of those containers go into the river? It's not going to affect me. It's going to affect hundreds and thousands and millions of people downriver because it's going to contaminate the water. It won't be usable anymore. The fish, it won't be edible anymore.
You know, I have a military background. I have a weapons background. I've worked in the weapons industry. I think they always wanted us to think, they being the government, that we have no voice, no control, nothing we can do. Trust us. We're your federal government. Believe in us. It's what they told the people in Hanford. It's what they told the people in Savannah River, Fernald. They're telling us that in New Mexico. Not acceptable again. Not acceptable.
Well, there's been 173 radioactive accidents across the country. 34 of those have happened in New Mexico.
We do have some rationale because we've been shipping this waste from Rocky Flats in Colorado up to Idaho for a very long period of time, 25 years or more. And we have had accidents, but there has never been a release. And there has never been a release of radiation from a Type B container.
Right. It may well be that with all the transportation of all these high-level waste and transuranic waste, we may be ending up with Chernobyls along the nuclear highways. Because if there's ever any spill of plutonium of a significant degree, it'll be so devastating that it'll render large parts of this country uninhabitable.
The documentary, The WIP Trail, was produced by Penelope Place. Now let's turn our attention to the alternative press and take a look at some news stories which the regular media don't give to you.
We've all heard the term apple polishers, and we've heard the term apple for the teacher. You know, a child gets an apple and he polishes up an apple polisher. That was another term that we hear all the time. Somebody gets and polishes up an apple real nice and makes it shine, and they go give it to the teacher. Well, you got to be wary of waxed apples and veggies now, because the veggies and the gloss may have more than you bargained for. Maybe even a little bit of cancer. But there are products ranging from relatively non-toxic beeswax and paraffin to more toxic vinyl chloride polymers, or PCBs, which companies put on these products. Then several fungicides can be added to the waxes. That's what makes them deadly. Some of them are known for their potential to cause cancer and birth defects. And the EPA considers OPP, which is orthophenol, whatever, it's placing it on its list of the most toxic inerts. A recent National Academy of Scientists report says that 90% of the fungicides that they've tested are carcinogenic. And these waxes, the problem with the waxes is they cannot be washed off effectively, even with vinegar and a detergent. Now, does the government look out for us? Despite a January 1987 finding that the EPA was arbitrary and capricious in allowing fruit treated with 1984 banned carcinogen ethylene dibromide, or EDB, to be imported into the United States, what did the Circuit Court of Appeals do? Well, it decided to go ahead and allow EDB to be used on mangoes through September of 1987. This is an old article, as you can see, but you better watch out when you start looking at that nice, shiny, waxy apple or other types of fruits or vegetables. You better go to your health food store and get you some organic food, folks.
According to a broadcast on Radio New Zealand, the Greenpeace yacht Vega is maintaining a vigil in a 125,000-square-mile missile impact zone north of the Marshall Islands, despite warnings to stay out of the impact zone by the U.S. military. United States intercontinental missiles are expected to be test-fired into the area from California at any time. Greenpeace says that it's worried about the cumulative effects on the ozone layer from such missile tests that have been conducted in the Marshall Islands since the 1960s. And to protest these missile tests, they have their yacht floating around in the waters near these islands to try to prevent the missiles from being fired. So this is really putting your life on the line for your philosophy.
Well, you better check to see what you got underneath your arms. Maybe something that'll chip paint on cars. It seems that workers in Chrysler Corporation's Jeep plant, according to the Associated Press, have been asked to stop using antiperspirants because they leave craters on the paint of vehicles and causes thousands of dollars of damage. It seems that these antiperspirants contain aluminum, chlorine, silicon, and when it flakes off the armpits of the workers, it gets down onto the cars, and if the flakes aren't removed before a car is painted, the paint flows away and causes small craters. And at one point, according to the Associated Press, nearly every vehicle coming off the paint line had been cratered. So you better check to see what you're putting underneath your arms.
There's an article by Common Cause magazine of March and April of 1990 that indicate that three of the most powerful men in the world have a little oil venture on the side, that they share a long-standing financial interest in a Houston-based tank barge business that's one of the major polluters in the United States. These three men with their barge happen to be George Bush, Secretary of Commerce Robert Mosbacher, and Secretary of State James Baker. This is curious, Common Cause says, because the Bush administration has proclaimed itself the environmental presidency. The tank barge industry is a major polluter of U.S. waterways, and the company that manages the Bush, Mosbacher, Baker barges is one of the largest tank barge companies in the United States. Collectively, its barges, which carry petroleum products, has spilled upwards of 200 times since 1980, government documents show. The ultimate parent company of this Bush, Mosbacher, Baker barges is the Hollywood Holding Company, an umbrella corporation that's splintered for tax purposes and to make sure these guys don't get sued for pollution. But it's basically controlled by a bunch of Houston interests, of which Mosbacher and Bush and Baker are big players. In 1978, Mosbacher bought a lot of this company, and his buddy George Bush also bought into this to the tune of $50,000, and James Baker also invested $50,000 in Hollywood Holding Company. Later in 1979 and 80, Baker invested at least $125,000 more in Hollywood partnerships, and Mosbacher made big investments throughout the 1980s. Well, this is the only actual economic holding that Bush put on his income taxes in 1988. All of the rest of his economic holdings were put in a blind trust, which meant that he didn't know if they were sold, if new ones were bought. He didn't supposedly know what his financial holdings were, but he knew he had Hollywood holdings simply because it was so lucrative. The Bushes reaped $130,000 from his original investment in the bank, in the tank barge partnership, and Bush continues to reap $20,000 a year for the foreseeable future off of this investment that, again, is one of the biggest polluters in the United States. It should be said in conclusion, though, that in 1989, after the Exxon Valdez spill, in which oil pollution became a big issue with media focus, finally Bush decided to put his Hollywood holding interest in a blind trust so he wouldn't be accused of having economic interest in an industry that was a big polluter. Bush's hypocrisy knows no bounds. He calls himself the environmental president, and he himself has a big holdings in a company that's one of the biggest polluters in the country.
It's a bit important to know a little bit about the people who are trying to get the presidential nominations for the, both Democratic and the Republican parties. There are some things about Bill Clinton, for instance, that haven't been in the mainstream media. Spotlight on March 16th, 1992 had an article about the big sugar daddy behind Clinton. His name is Jackson Stevens. He's the head man in Stevens Incorporated, Little Rock, Arkansas investment firm, one of the largest investment banks in the country. He's a bit of a reclusive figure who's one of the men involved in the starting up of BCCI, according to the Spotlight, and he is financing Bill Clinton. He also did this before. He arranged for the Arkansas governor to have a $2 million line of credit to keep his campaign rolling for governor previously. However, as in true single-party fashion, you know, we always say we have a single-party system just split into two halves, and John Stockwell calls it the A-team, the Republicans, and the B-team, the Democrats, but it's all the same team. But anyway, old Jackson Stevens is a big buddy of George Bush as well. Stevens' wife, Mary Ann, was the 1988 co-chairperson for the Bush for President drive, and Stevens himself donated $100,000 to Team 100, which is a Republican group that collected big bucks for Bush's big push for the White House. And then in 1991, lo and behold, Stevens comes up with another $100,000 to Bush in May. There's another thing about Clinton which nobody has brought out yet, and that is that he is a member of the highly secret and very elite Bilderberg organization, a very secret group of international power brokers dominated, or at least a little bit of shared power perhaps now, by David Rockefeller. And the people who are invited to Bilderberg or meetings are very carefully screened, and so they generally run through the Bilderbergers or Trilateral Commission or the Council on Foreign Relations, the people whom they are wanting to support later to run for president and frequently vice president of the United States. So we do have Bill Clinton, who is a Bilderberger, and George Bush, who's former member of the Trilateral Commission. So it's all a little cozy group there. And don't forget Big Daddy Buck Stevens, who is supporting them both with his money.
I don't think we as a nation or as a society or as a world can any longer afford to take nice, neat little problems, package them up, and assign them to bureaucracies and expect those problems to be solved. We just cannot do that. We have to participate in this ourselves. We have to stay involved. And if we can't stay involved, maybe we shouldn't get into them.
We don't know. We've got it. We don't know what to do with it. That's the thing on it. If we've got it and don't know what to do with it, why should we need more? We ought to find out some way of doing something with it or getting rid of it before we start making more for another stockpile.
Brings up the question, why do we continue to produce these things? Why do we continue to put our people in jeopardy just even by things of this kind where we're transporting them through cities and over highways and into the very lives of the populace? Perhaps I can't throw the first stone. Again, I'm not without sin. I think that I could wish that my life had run entirely different. I'm just grateful that I've lived long enough to have an opportunity to view things differently, though, turn my thinking around and recognize what's going on. Or I hope that my view is freer of the stigmatism that I once had.
I felt personally humiliated because I did not speak out at a very critical, a very pivotal time. And so I took that humiliation back with me to the Savannah River plant and slowly began to confront myself and to resolve the issues within myself and to know what I had to do and to go forward from that point on. It's a very slow process, but it's a very difficult process for most people, at least it was for me, to confront yourself and to come to terms with it and then to finally start doing what you think is right. And then the more that you do it, the easier it becomes.
Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We would like to thank the Campaign for Global Security, particularly Jim Ellinger and Jeff Sibley, for facilitating our program today. And special thanks to Mark Morey, who let us use his wonderful documentary, or sections of it, Building Bombs. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.